From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's primary day in Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Michigan. We'll look at the impact of NAFTA on these Midwest industrial states and discuss the Third Way, a new proposal for just and sustainable trade policies. Also, we'll speak with workers affected by two current labor battles, Detroit newspaper strikers and United Auto Workers on strike against GM in Dayton, Ohio.
The overtime right now is unreal. We've got people working 10, 12-hour days, some 16-hour days, 6 and 7 days a week. We feel that if we can get more jobs in there or more people in there, we can reduce some of the amount of the overtime. The effects of the overtime, you know, being in a repetitious job is causing a lot of arm and hand injuries.
And 21st Century Vote. A former gang member is shaking up Chicago by getting involved in electoral politics. That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Pat Buchanan's appeal to alienated white working class voters has gotten the Clinton administration in a stir over how heavily to promote so-called free trade, what others call more free lunches for wealthy corporations. Especially during this election year. Today, there's an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal about the internal White House debate over whether to include the Caribbean Basin Initiative, which is called CBI, which in some ways extends NAFTA to the Caribbean in the budget, which President Clinton is releasing today. Vice President Gore won out, and it will be included. They're also talking about extending the NAFTA sphere to Chile. Now, of course, the White House is concerned about the political fallout, what it sounds like when he talks about free trade, how it's heard. We're concerned about the facts, what NAFTA has done in this country. And we're joined now by Sarah Anderson, who is an Institute for Policy Studies fellow. She's been studying NAFTA for a few years now. Today is the primary that is taking place, the Midwest primaries taking place in Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin. Let's start with these Midwestern states, Sarah. How has NAFTA affected them?
Okay, Amy. Well, I'll be the first to admit that it's impossible to calculate exactly how many people have lost their jobs to NAFTA. Last week, the AFL-CIO took a crack at it, looking at the tremendous trade deficit that we now have with Mexico, which is about $15.4 billion, and using that and the idea that all of these increased imports do displace jobs here in the U.S., the AFL-CIO is estimating that as many as 300,000 workers across the country have lost their jobs under NAFTA. Well, today we're going to be looking just at these four states which have the primaries, and again, they're Illinois, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And one indicator of how many people have lost their jobs there is by looking at the retraining program that was set up under NAFTA for U.S. workers who lose their jobs as the result of the agreement. Now, we know that these figures are only a small fraction of the total job loss, but they are interesting in terms of finding out what kind of trends are happening. And looking at these four states, I see that laid-off workers at 87 firms have filed claims for NAFTA retraining assistance. That's about average for across the country. But looking a little bit further into these 87 cases, what really stands out in these four states is how many of them were unionized plants. The Midwest is still a heavily unionized region of the country, and especially compared to the NAFTA job losses we're seeing in the South, which tend to be non-union, lower-paying jobs in the apparel and electronics sector, what we're seeing in these four primary states are more union jobs. And that really gets at the whole issue of the 90s, I think, which is not so much what the number of jobs is, but the quality of those jobs. And a lot of people who are losing those union jobs are finding that while they may find another job, the quality of that new job is not as good as the one that they lost. And if I could just tell one specific example, there's a company called Owens Brockway, which has a number of plants in the Chicago area. Well, only one of Owens Brockway's plants was closed last year as the result of NAFTA. Coincidentally, it was the only unionized Owens Brockway plant in the Chicago area. Well, the company offered the workers at that plant jobs at their other non-unionized plants, but if they were going to take those jobs, they were going to have to take at least a 30% pay cut and start working 12-hour shifts. So that's just one graphic example of what's happening to workers who lose their jobs under NAFTA. They might get another job, but it's very likely going to be lower paying. It might be a temp job. It might be part-time. And that's why when the governors of these four states are going around bragging so much about the low unemployment rates in their states, we should be asking, what kind of jobs are those jobs?
Now, Sarah, a lot of people say that since NAFTA was instituted 2 years ago, that the trend isn't that much bigger in terms of jobs being lost and corporations moving, say, to Mexico, that this was already happening.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there has been a very steep acceleration of job loss. If you look at the people who are applying for the NAFTA retraining program, especially since the Mexican economic crisis hit in December of 94, we've seen almost a doubling in the rate of people who are applying for this program. And it makes a lot of sense. Companies that are operating in Mexico right now are paying their workers in very devalued pesos, but they're selling their products in the U.S. for dollars. So they're making tremendous profits there, and a lot of companies are moving to take advantage of that.
How about in the Midwest compared to the rest of the country? How does the Midwest compare?
I think in terms of the number of layoffs, as I said, it's about average. As I said, there were 87 firms that had NAFTA-related layoffs in those four states. Other areas are much higher, and they tend to be in the South, in Texas, Florida. Also, Pennsylvania has had, I think, almost 200 layoffs. So it's The number in the Midwest states is average, but as I said before, what makes them significant is that they tend to be higher paying union jobs that they're losing in those Midwest states.
And again, Sarah Anderson is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where, interestingly enough, Pat Buchanan gets a lot of his ideas on trade. He gets all the documents that you all put out. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think I want to take credit for shaping Buchanan's policies. I think they're actually very different from ours and are coming from a very different place. In fact, we have recently helped to draft a statement in response to Buchanan, and it's being put out by the Alliance for Responsible Trade, which is a broad-based coalition that came together to fight NAFTA. And we drafted this response to Buchanan for a couple reasons. One is because, to be honest, it's quite embarrassing for many of us who are opposed to NAFTA to be thrown into the same camp as Buchanan. And we wanted to very clearly lay out how our positions differ from his. Another reason why we drafted this statement was because we saw the spotlight on Buchanan as providing us an opportunity for getting across the idea that there is a third way, that the debate on trade is not simply between the protectionists like Buchanan on the one hand and the free traders like Bob Dole and Bill Clinton on the other. And this statement we released to anti-NAFTA members of Congress last week because we think that it will be very useful for them in defending themselves against allegations that they're just like Buchanan, that they're racist and protectionist just like Buchanan. We hope this will give them the idea that there is another way. And basically, the people who are supporting this third way are people who see that trade is not all bad. That trade does have benefits. What is bad is that under NAFTA, the benefits of trade are gained by only a few, namely the big corporations. And we feel that we need a different type of agreement that would ensure that the benefits of trade are spread out more equitably across society.
Why don't we talk about what the Alliance for Responsible Trade has specifically come up with in responding to what you're calling Buchanomics?
Well, the first part of the statement lays out the differences between Buchanan's position and ours. And I think to put it simply, Buchanan's solution to the problems that we agree are the result of NAFTA, the job insecurity, the weakening environmental protections, the job loss, and those type of problems. He sees the solution to all of that as being simply to raise a wall between the U.S. and Mexico, to cut off the flow of goods and people. And we think that that is not a legitimate solution to these problems. First of all, on the immigration issue, we see that the reason why there is an increase in immigration from Mexico to the U.S. is the result of policies like NAFTA and other related development policies in Mexico. And it's those policies that need to be attacked, not the immigrants, as Buchanan is doing. On the trade issue, we feel that it's unrealistic to assume that by raising a wall, you can stop U.S. corporations from moving to the U.S. to Mexico. We feel that the only way we're going to reduce the incentives for companies to do that is by leveling the playing field, by bringing between U.S. and Mexican workers, by bringing up wages and working conditions in Mexico. If we don't do that, there's no way we're going to stop U.S. corporations from moving there, only to take advantage of workers and the environment in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. What about the issue of debt?
Well, that's another serious issue that we feel needs to be addressed. The Mexican economy is going to always be strapped, and it will be always difficult for them to create the kind of economic well-being that would help people stay there instead of leaving in desperation for the U.S. And we feel that if we're really serious about dealing with Mexico's economic problems, we're going to have to renegotiate the Mexico's foreign debt and relieve a lot of that burden.
One of the things that Pat Buchanan talks about is the World Trade Organization, the specter of a world government taking over. What is your view on the World Trade Organization? And first of all, what is it?
What is the World Trade Organization? You put me on the spot here. It is what used to be called the GATT, and it is supposed to handle trade disputes amongst most of the nations of the world. We agree with a more multilateral approach to handling trade disputes. And so in that way, we are different from Buchanan, who sees it as a very big threat to our sovereignty. What we don't like about the WTO is that we don't think it's very democratic. It's still mostly technocrats and big businesses who are calling the shots there. And we believe very strongly that trade is an issue that needs to be dealt with, not just by big corporations. When these deals are negotiated, we want workers, representatives from environmental groups, community groups, consumer groups, other representatives of civil society at the table. And then I think we'll come out with very different types of agreements. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that just recently Canada went to the World Trade Organization. They filed a grievance on the Helms-Burton Act that Clinton mm-hmm. just signed off on, saying that it is an obstacle to trade, and they're objecting to it, and Mexico is joining them with this because both Mexico and Canada trade with Cuba, and this Helms-Burton bill is going to apply sanctions to companies that, even if they are in Canada, even if they are in Mexico, that do business with Cuba. Let me ask you about the code of conduct that you're proposing mm-hmm. for corporations.
Well, we think that any new agreement that would be a better alternative to NAFTA would have to be much more aggressive in holding corporations accountable for their actions. Free trade agreements like NAFTA give all kinds of benefits to corporations, and we think that they should have to give something back. For example, it's the corporations that are polluting the U.S.-Mexico border, and we think they should have to pay to clean it up. It's corporations that are profiting when they violate labor rights and exploit workers, mainly in Mexico, but also here in the U.S. and in Canada, and we think they should have to pay for that too. So I think any new agreement would need to include codes of conduct for corporations and much stronger mechanisms for holding them accountable.
How can the U.S. government, instead of luring corporations south of the border, which often they do, and they have been called on occasionally by Congress, for example, actually supporting ads in trade magazines like Bobbin for the garment workers, that encourages corporations to go south of the border to El Salvador, where wages are lower. Mm-hmm. How can the U.S. government, can a government prevent mm-hmm. a corporation from leaving? And do you think that's a good idea?
Well, I think it all gets down to what are the incentives there for corporations. Right now, every incentive is to pick up and move to Mexico. And that's why I think we need this new renegotiated type of NAFTA that would include much stronger provisions so that when corporations violate the rights of workers, when they violate environmental protections in NAFTA, that they know they are going to have to pay for that. And that is the only real way to reduce the incentives for them moving there.
Again, Sarah Anderson, a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies here in Washington, D.C. Now, in terms of your differences with Pat Buchanan, over the last few months, when the corporate media has been talking about Buchanan as pro-labor, here on Democracy Now! We've been talking about what his real record is. For example, he doesn't support an increase in the minimum wage.
Right.
He was part of the Reagan administration, which was busted the PATCO strike, the air traffic controllers. What about the issue of striker replacement? We had believed that Pat Buchanan was for striker replacement, yet this past weekend, it sounds like he went on TV and said he was for a ban on striker replacement.
Well, I have my own theory on why he made that surprise announcement. Early last week, I got a call from someone in Buchanan's office, and he was asking me about statistics related to the auto industry. And I said, gee, I'm not really an expert on this. Why haven't you called the United Auto Workers, the UAW? And he laughed rather nervously and said, well, actually, we have been trying to call them, but they don't seem to want to return our phone calls. And so my guess is that this surprise announcement of Pat Buchanan to put a ban on permanent replacement of strikers is a last-ditch effort to not only get the UAW to start returning his phone calls, but also to deliver the troops today in these primary states where the UAW has a high concentration.
You think if things get desperate later on today, he might call for an increase in the minimum wage?
I think it's likely. I think Pat really misses being the hotshot, the man in the spotlight, and he's willing to do a lot to get more support. And labor is one area that people have thought would give him a lot of support. I really don't think that they will. I think that the racist and nationalist solutions that Pat Buchanan has been putting out are not going to appeal to most rank-and-file members, people who were opposed to NAFTA. I think one good thing about NAFTA was that it was a tremendous educational opportunity for many people. Thousands of people in the labor movement went down to Mexico, toured plants, met with Mexicans who worked for the same companies they do, and they understand that the worse things get in Mexico, the worse things are going to get here in the U.S., that we need to support the working people in Mexico, or there's not going to be any way to stop U.S. corporations from taking advantage of them.
Who has signed your statement so far?
Well, we've just begun to get signers, and we have about 20 now. It's a very diverse group. There are about three labor unions, a couple of environmental groups, two family farm organizations. There are a number of religious groups and a few research institutes. But as I said, we have released this to anti-NAFTA members of Congress, but we are continuing to use this statement and will throughout the election season. So if there are people out there who are interested in seeing this statement, which is a citizen's response to Buchanan and his economic policies, people could give me a call. And so I'd like to give out my number, if I may. It's here in Washington, D.C. at 202-234-9382, extension 227. That's 202-234-9382, extension 227. And if you give me a call and leave me your fax number, I'll fax you the statement. You can see if you'd like to also endorse it, either as an individual or an organization.
A couple of weeks ago, I got a chance to speak to Jay Mazur, the president of Unite, the newly formed union between Amalgamated Clothing Textile Workers Union and the ILG, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. Mm-hmm. I asked him about how he could be standing with Hillary Clinton, which he was in New York, after they had fought so hard against NAFTA. We just have a few seconds to go, but he said, well, it's one of a number of issues. Do you see NAFTA as just one of a number of issues in the Clinton administration?
I think it's more than just one of a number of issues. I think it's he's made it into his foreign policy. He's made it into one of his greatest achievements. And the thing about NAFTA is that it's tied to so many other policies, and it reflects a general attitude towards workers. it's a policy that was designed for the interests of the Fortune 500 and not with the interests of workers and communities in mind. And that's why it says so much about who he is.
Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies, thank you very much for joining us. Coming up next, Two Strikes. You're listening to Democracy Now! And welcome back to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's National Daily Grassroots Election Show. I'm Amy Goodman. Negotiators wrapped up 40 hours of nonstop talks early today as a crippling strike by General Motors Corporation brake workers entered its third week. In Dayton, Ohio, 2,700 United Auto Worker members who work for General Motors have been on strikes for that amount of time, and they are protesting the issue of outsourcing, contracting out for parts. Talks between the UAW and GM will probably resume today, and the strike has idled about 150,000 GM workers at more than 20 GM plants in the U.S., in Mexico, and Canada, resulting in projected lost production of about 93,000 automobiles. We got a hold of Dave Shores, who is a member of UAW Local 696. He says the issue is jobs.
We need jobs for our kids and our kids' kids.
What about issues like overtime and outsourcing?
Okay, the overtime right now is unreal. We've got people working 10, 12 hour days. Some 16-hour days, 6 and 7 days a week. We feel that if we can get more jobs in there or more people in there, we can reduce some of the amount of the overtime. The effects of the overtime, you know, being in a repetitious job is causing a lot of arm and hand injuries from repetitive motion. And so by lightening the load on the overtime, we can get rid of some of those injuries.
We hear in the media a lot about outsourcing. Can you explain what that is?
Outsourcing, there is an agreement between the GM and the UAW that if there's a supplier that puts a bid on a job and can do it cheaper than we can, we have 150 days to come up with an alternative method and try to get that cost down. Okay, and if we can reach below the cost, if we can hit that target, we can keep the job. Okay, now if we don't hit that target, then the jobs are sent out.
And where are they sent to?
Whoever bids on them.
And so what do you want to happen?
Well, I'd like to keep the jobs in there if we're competitive with that job. You know, GM's a good place to work. You know, it's good money, good benefits. And the jobs out there, there's not any jobs out in the world like GM anymore. We'd like to keep that.
What kind of attention have you been getting from politicians, for example? Have the presidential candidates made stops at your picket line?
No presidential candidates have stopped yet. Don't really expect any right now.
What about presidential candidate Robert Dole? Wasn't he in town?
He was not in Dayton. He stopped up in Marysville at the Honda plant. I know that he was there, but I have no idea what he said or anything like that.
So there was no plant. There was no strike at the Honda plant.
No.
How did you take this?
Well, the Honda plant, as far as I know, is non-union.
Are there any politicians out there who have expressed support for your strike?
No politicians per se. We did receive a letter from Jesse Jackson.
What did he say?
That he was just congratulating the local on their courage.
What kind of support have you been getting from other workers?
That's unreal. We've had several locals come in. We had a local last week from Flint, Michigan. They brought, it was about 50 or 60 people. They come in, join our picketers on the picket line. We had a local from Sandusky. Today we had three members from the Ford plant in Milan, Michigan come down. They had a letter that had been blown up and signed by everybody in the plant and is now hanging in the window where the negotiations are being held at.
I hear your child in the background. What kind of impact has the strike had on your family?
It's rough. I'm gone a lot more now, helping out at the Union Hall, wherever they need me at. And it's tough. You know, I have a wife that's disabled, and I have two stepdaughters, one being autistic. And I need to be home.
What would you like to see the president do, or the presidential candidates?
As far as the strike's concerned?
Mm-hmm.
I'm really not worried about the politicians. We want to get these things settled. We want to get back to work. You know, we build the best break in the world, and we want to keep going.
I was wondering if your wife is around, if she might be able
right
to come
here.
To the phone.
Her name's Jill.
Hello.
Hi, is this Jill Shores?
This is.
Hi, this is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!, which is a national election radio show.
How are you?
Good. I was wondering how the strike is affecting you and your daughters.
Very nerve-wracking for myself. Try to keep my daughters in as normal situation as possible. My youngest one is autistic, so we kind of have a different daily living arrangement than most normal families do, so that in itself is very stressful, and with my husband being on strike right now, it's very stressful, very emotional, and I'm probably the most emotional person in the world. I kind of wear my heart on my shoulder, and when my husband looks at me, he knows if I'm scared, worried, angry, upset, or whatever. So we talk a lot. We hold each other a lot. We tell each other we love each other more than we ever have. And we just try to take hour by hour, minute by minute, if that's what it takes to get through it. So,
how about sources of support outside your family? For example, do you in any way look to politicians to solve the problems here? Do you look to the president or to the presidential candidates to make any comments?
That's the furthest thing from my mind right now. My support is within the local union here in Dayton, Ohio. It's president and the members. My husband has very good faith in them, and that's enough for me. So I look to the hearts of all of those to sit down and come to some kind of an agreement that will not only benefit my family, but the whole world, if so need be, for our future.
I appreciate you coming to the phone. Could you put your husband back on for a minute?
Yes, I sure will.
Thanks a lot.
Hello.
Hi. Dave Shores, I was just wondering, earlier you said that GM is the best job in the world. Why do you say that?
I'm not saying it's the best job in the world. It's a very hard job, okay? But the money and the benefits are what's great. You don't find jobs out there anymore that has the money and the benefits that GM does.
You think it's going to stay that way?
I'd like to see it stay that way, yes. I understand a company's position where they have to get competitive, and like other companies before GM, where they always reduce the cost. They stay competitive at the workers' cost.
How long have you been at the plant?
20 years.
What do you do?
I'm an assembler.
Which means?
I help assemble the brake assemblies.
And how much money do you make before the strike and now?
Well, you know, I was making General Motors wages before the strike, and now we get a strike benefit of $150 a week.
Do you think you can hold out long?
I have a side business that should be starting up next month. It's going to be a struggle.
Dave Shores, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dave Shores is one of 2,700 United Auto Workers who work for General Motors are in the third week of their strike in Ohio, one of today's primary states. The strike at the two Dayton parts plants has idled about 150,000 GM workers in the United States, Mexico, and Canada. Another of the states where voters are going to the polls today is Michigan. There, the Detroit newspaper strike's been going on since last summer with no end in sight. All the unions have stuck it out except for the Newspaper Guild, half of whose members have gone back to work at the Detroit News or the Detroit Free Press. The two papers have continued to publish with replacement workers. Strikers have put out an alternative paper of their own, the Detroit Sunday Journal, which has a circulation of 300,000. We're joined now by two people who are on strike. Norman Sinclair is the editor of the Detroit Sunday Journal. We're also joined by Anne-Marie Zenimer, who is a Teamster who works with distribution of the paper. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Hello.
Hi. Why don't we begin with Norman Sinclair? Can you tell us what is at issue here in this strike?
Well, basically, Amy, it's job security. It's taking care of people who have spent 20 to 30 years helping these newspapers get into a very profitable position. It's folks who have lived for the last 3 years without a wage increase, accepting a freeze 3 years ago, giving back to the companies, and having very little to show for it 3 years later.
What sparked the strike?
Well, our contract expired in April, and all six unions were working without a contract while negotiating for a new one. And on July 13th, there was a strike deadline set, and the company decided that they did not want to go along with the arrangement of continuing to negotiate. On the day of the strike, the mayor of Detroit, Dennis Archer, tried to intervene. The six unions agreed to continue negotiating and continued to work under the old contracts, and the company said no and foreclosed on the contracts.
Anne-Marie Zenimer, you're a Teamster who works with distributing the alternative to the papers that are on strike, the Detroit Sunday Journal. How do you get this paper out to 300,000 people? How does it work?
Oh, well, we have actually started out with the same way that the news in the Free Press was delivered. We deliver to stores and dealers, and then we also did what we called random home delivery to introduce our paper to the people. In the last 4 weeks, we have also started up mail subscription, actually mailing the copies of the paper to people.
What kind of support are you getting? Are you getting any from local politicians, for example? What about community groups?
We're getting enormous support from politicians, from the community has been tremendous in their support. As a matter of fact, in the last 3 weeks, the community themselves, including a large sector of the religion community, have been sponsoring rallies in front of the news building to show their support. We had 44 women arrested last week for civil disobedience, and the prior week to that, we had, I believe, over 20 religious leaders also demonstrate the same sort of support.
Anne-Marie Zenimer, you are a Teamster, and I wanted to ask how much of the fact that this strike has gone on for so many months has to do with a presidential campaign of your own, which is in the Teamsters, between Jimmy Hoffa Jr. and the current President Kerry. The fact that this really, your area, is Jimmy Hoffa Jr.'s stronghold, and that if this were settled, it would make Ron Kerry look good.
Well, actually, after 8 months of the strike, I know you refer to me as a Teamster, but in this eight-month-old strike, there are six other unions. And I believe myself, amongst with all these other unions, we don't refer to ourselves as guild members anymore, or Teamsters, or CWA. We've become so united that I believe the issues between Cary and Hoffa are our least concern right now. Our main concern is reaching the public and the community and letting them know what's going on here has nothing to do with unions as in Hoffa and Cary. It has what we're our concern, our workers. Concerned.
Let me ask you another question. During the course of the strike, there was a change in leadership at the AFL-CIO with the election of Sweeney. Has that had any impact on the strike?
They have showed tremendous support. As a matter of fact, at the convention in Miami, which was approximately 3 weeks ago, we were invited. Six rank-and-file members were invited to the actual conference, and we were also invited into the executive committee meeting where the support was tremendous, not only emotionally but financially. And they've vowed to stand by our side and see this through.
Norman Sinclair, I wanted to ask you about coverage of your strike. I mean, after all, it is a newspaper strike. How are other newspapers around the country covering it? I mean, we're looking at unions at the New York Times, at the Wall Street Journal, at the Washington Post.
I think they do a lukewarm job of covering it only because it's a curiosity. I mean, to hear that worker from Dayton, they've been on strike for 3 weeks. We're going into our ninth month. And the New York Times, their local bureau wrote a story back in October that the strike was over, which is basically the propaganda that the company has put out. The problem we have is that both newspapers are publishing. They look the same, but when you pick them up, you can see that there's hardly anything in it. We broke the biggest story that they've had in Michigan for some time now on the FBI's attempt to derail organized crime in the state. We had the story back on December 10th. It broke here last week with both newspapers running screaming headlines as if World War III had been declared.
Would you call Detroit a union town?
Absolutely. But what you have here are two almost foreign companies, Gannett and Knight Ridder, coming to town with a plan to try to wipe these newspaper unions out. And because of the electronic capability today, they can produce the product, the newspaper, and they have been able to convince a lot of the media that come to town, you know, look at the paper. See, we're producing a paper. The strike is over. Those folks out there are doing a futile effort at continuing the strike.
Have any of the presidential candidates stop by, show their support?
Well, the closest we got to any of that was Bill Clinton. He was in town a couple of weeks ago to dedicate a public building in a suburb south of Detroit, Taylor, and he was giving a speech several blocks away from the Detroit News building. His motorcade at the dedication, one of our guild officers managed to get into the reception line with her sign, her picket sign, shook hands with the president and invited him to the picket line. He demurred coming to the picket line, but something must have happened after he gave his speech downtown, because his motorcade, instead of leaving the hall and going straight to the expressway, there's an exit right there, an entrance ramp right there, instead of getting on the expressway, they came up about four blocks from the hall where he spoke and passed within a half a block of the Detroit News, where all the picketers could come over to the corner and wave at him, and he gave him the thumbs up sign.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Norman Sinclair, Detroit Sunday Journal editor, and Anne-Marie Zennemer, Teamster, who works with distribution of the alternative paper as the Detroit newspaper strike continues into its ninth month. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and as we look at these labor struggles in the context of the presidential primaries, we decided to go back in history and look at how presidents and candidates deal with strikes, have dealt with them in the past. A number of presidents and candidates made their reputation on labor issues by breaking strikes. Most recently, of course, Ronald Reagan, when he fired 11,000 striking air traffic controllers. A century before, President Grover Cleveland worked with his attorney general to send in federal troops to end the Pullman Railway car strike, a strike led by future Socialist Party presidential candidate Eugene V. Debs. In 1919, then-Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge broke the Boston police strike. His statement that there was no right to strike against the public health and safety anywhere, anytime, catapulted him into the national spotlight and propelled him to the presidency in 1924. And at the end of World War II, Harry Truman threatened to use federal troops to end strikes in defense-related industries. On the other hand, Socialist Party candidate Debs led strikes, and Norman Thomas, six-time Socialist Party presidential candidate from 1928 to 48, walked numerous picket lines. In recent years, Jesse Jackson and Tom Harkin have walked with picketing strikers, but have failed in their quest for the Democratic presidential nomination. And while he has said he would have supported the striking Boeing workers, Pat Buchanan has not yet appeared on any picket lines. Interestingly, it's the third-party candidates like Debs who've been most likely to appear on picket lines. Norman Thomas walked numerous lines. And by the way, we will continue covering these strikes. We'll continue covering them in the days to come. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we go to Chicago. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and joining me in Chicago is my co-host Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times and a contributing columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times. And Salim has been following this controversy surrounding a group of former gang members who are exerting their muscle politically in Chicago. Salim.
Good morning, Amy.
Morning.
Well, you know, today is the Illinois primary, and that's part of the whole Rust Belt primary. So one of the most contentious issues in today's primary is, and particularly in the state's 7th Congressional District, which is in Chicago's black community, is the presence of a group called 21st Century Vote. It's an organization that was formed basically as a vehicle to gain political influence and mobilize the growing numbers of disaffected youth who are attracted to street gangs in the city, and there's a huge number of youth who are attracted to these street gangs. But since the founders of the group, 21st Century Vote, are former members of the Gangster Disciples, which is Chicago's largest street gang, or Nation, as the gang members would say, police claim the group is merely a gang front. However, many community leaders and activists praise 21st Century Vote as a positive development, as something that is giving these youth who have very little else something positive to do and a productive way of channeling their energy. Wallace Gator Bradley is one of those community leaders who praises the group. But the 43-year-old Bradley himself is a controversial figure. He's an ex-inmate and a former gangster disciple enforcer himself. But he's now the director of an organization called United in Peace, which is a group deeply involved in the gang truce movement, which is a movement that blossomed following the 1992 disturbances in Los Angeles. Bradley is a member of this group, a growing group of black men who, in L.A. they call them OGs or original gangsters, who are urging youth that admire them to channel their energies in more constructive ways. But of course, the mainstream media and mainstream politicians deride their claims, and they claim that it's a ruse to try to gain more influence. Now, Wallace Bradley is here with us today, and he's become controversial himself because he's endorsed perhaps the most progressive candidate for the 7th Congressional District, and now the opponents of this candidate are using Gator Bradley's endorsement as a mark of odium for the candidate. Wallace, tell us a little bit about 21st Century Vote and why you think this organization and others like it across the country are becoming increasingly involved in political campaigns.
Well, I think it's because the African-American community is the last ethnic group that is channeling antisocial behavior out of our community. What I mean by that, the Irish community had their gangs. They had a gang here, and it's still here, as a matter of fact, called the Hamburg. Okay, Mayor Daley then was involved in the riots here in 1919, the race riots. A lot of their members went to the penitentiary and did wrong. But Mayor Daley's father decided that he wanted to do something right in his community. And as a matter of fact, we're using the story of Daley's father, known as the Boss, to help us do the right thing. I think what made them all concerned is that crime pays. It doesn't pay us, okay? Against the Disciple, unless they have 30,000 members, or growth and development, you know, it's not about Against the Disciple anymore.
Growth and development. Now, right. What do you mean by that?
Growth and development is something positive to put on their mind. You know, you grow and you develop. Okay, Against the Disciple has a negative edge, like you're trying to take something that doesn't belong to you. So
you mean you're using the initials, the GD, to put a new spin on the organization?
Because one of the things you have to do is, if you're trying to make something positive, you have to start off with something positive. Okay? If it's 30,000 members, and maybe 1,000 of them may be off to illicit activity, that's 29,000 that's not involved in illicit activity. When you see that 10,000 individuals march downtown to keep the schools from closing, to keep the health clinics open in our community.
And in fact, that's what happened. 21st Century Vote organized a massive demonstration in Chicago's Loop 2 years ago and virtually shut the city down.
Yeah, they did. You know, we did, you know, shut it down, but it was for a good reason. Mayor Daley was about to close the clinics in our community. So therefore, by the youth marching down to keep the clinics open, they realized that it was an AIDS epidemic within their community. You follow what I'm saying? We've learned to make them issue-orientated. And if one realized that it's issues like education and health care, they realize that, hey, it's best to go to school and it's not good to kill one another.
But the police have insisted that these efforts are basically ruses. That they're attempts by older gang members to influence young people and to put up a front of respectability.
You know, but you know, my thing is this: they don't say anything about the Irish gangs. They don't say anything about the Jewish gangs. They don't say anything about the Polish gangs. But during the peace summit that we had in Chicago, the mayor was against African Americans stopping killing one another. The state's attorney, the U.S. attorney's office.
When you say peace summits.
The peace summit is that we went across the country and met with gang leaders from around the country, Chicanos, Asians, white gang leaders, motorcycle gang leaders. Everyone came together, and it was about stopping the unwanted killing that was happening in the community. Innocent individuals were getting hurt. Okay, after Dantrell Davis got killed
in Chicago,
seven-year-old kid, yeah, over in Cabrini Green. Mm-hmm. Since we put the peace summit together, you know the truth, it hasn't been any homicides over there since '92. Okay, so when they realize that people like Gator, and I have support from Mr. Farrakhan, Jesse Jackson, Prince Asiel, Robbie Ben-Ami up out of Israel, you know, the African-American Hebrews, Ben Chavis, got support from Quasi and Fume, you know, because it was the right thing to do.
And you've even recently gained some mainstream support. I think the Chicago Urban League has enlisted.
Of course. Well, you know, first of all, before everything joined with us, I even went and met with President Clinton in the Oval Office, okay, a day before he gave his State of the Union address in order to find a solution to urban problems.
Well, he apparently didn't listen to what you said.
No, he didn't.
He didn't even mention the urban situation.
Right. Well, you know, he feels that he doesn't have to. Okay.
And is it the intention of groups like 21st Century Vote to make these politicians respond to situations?
Right. I think what it is, what has to happen, elected officials have to be held accountable to their constituency the same way they want to hold gang members accountable for the bad things happening in the community. They say, okay.
And aren't gang members... Shouldn't they be held accountable?
They should be held accountable. Everyone should, okay? But to me, when I see them jumping all over James Compton,
who's the executive director of the Urban League,
because he's doing what his mission statement states that he must do. He's receiving funds to reach out to disenfranchised youth to turn them around to something positive. And when I see that the Illinois Crime Commission, that has no law enforcement, you know, type of thing, just got a name, want to tell the, I think it was the United Way, not to give any money to the Urban League because they are working with the youth, 21st Century Vote, with a part of a coalition, only to have them register and vote, not to have them do anything else, but to register people and to vote. And I feel like since this is supposed to be a democracy, what do you want them to do? Do you want them to shoot one another, or do you want them to vote?
Wallace, that's a very good question, and it's one that comes to mind frequently when I hear politicians denounce these efforts by groups like 21st Century Vote. Why do you think there's such relentless opposition to your attempts to become legitimate players in the political?
Right. Well, first of all, a lot of the elected officials, African-American elected officials, they were just like us in the 60s. Okay, I'm 43. I stood on a lot of picket lines with them. Okay, they got into office and they don't care. You know, they left a vacuum there. Okay, I got grandchildren. Okay, 21st century is about cyberspace. You know, the internet. Okay, the reason that the name 21st Century Vote came into play is because it was putting it on the youth's mind. They're going into the 21st century in order to be voices, that's V, of total empowerment, that's O-T-E. You know, dealing with the mind, they may call it subliminal.
Seduction?
Yeah, you know, or suggestion.
Okay.
You follow what I'm saying?
I understand. Are there similar efforts like this in other cities?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. In Washington, D.C., in L.A., I mean, we end up in the World Book Encyclopedia in 1994 because we did the summits from Kansas City to California to Cleveland to Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, to Detroit. Chicago ran for 5 days. And during each time we had a summit in individual
cities. This is the
peace
summit.
The peace summit.
And this political development grew out of these peace summits.
It did. You know how some people always have the conventions and they have an agenda and say what they're going to do. Okay, we had an agenda. Our purpose was to make the schools safe, okay, not just for our children, for all children. If an individual in one of the organizations wanted to go to school, he had, like, carte blanche. He must go to school. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? What you need? You need some books or you need a bookcase? We got to get that for you. And the fact that no one was to stalk a woman, you know, disrespect the senior citizen, okay, weren't supposed to abuse any children.
And these,
okay, they were to register.
These are bylaws in the group.
Right. And every town was about it. As a matter of fact, the Million Man March was pretty much what came out of the summit because Farrakhan was going to speak at each town and saw how the brothers was coming together. I mean, we were just like convention is. We had our little ID cards, and we worked with the police in the community. You feel what I'm saying? The superintendent of police in every town that we had the summit. We dealt with the mayor, the state's attorney's office. But the thing that gets me in Chicago, the biggest gang in this town is Fraternal Order Police. You know?
Right. Well,
and, I'm just saying that to say, in this town, true. You have a state's attorney They know that a police officer killed a homeless man, murdered him. And then through the manipulation of his office, he obstructed justice. Okay?
Yeah.
Only because they were members of the Fraternal Order of Police.
Well, that's true, and that's another issue we may deal with in the future. But one other thing I wanted to say about this group is so many young black men are becoming involved with the criminal justice system. The Sentencing Project has released statistics citing the startling figure, 1/3 of all young black men in their 20s. And this seems to be an attempt to redirect the lives of these young black men who
right.
come into contact.
It is, because, like I said earlier, crime pays for them. For each individual that we're able to stop from going to the penitentiary, that's $30,000 of taxpayers' money that they don't have to spend to a contractor who may have got a no-bid contract. Okay, since they got the crack law, that's 5 years mandatory. So you figure that's $150,000 per individual. If you stop 10, that's $1.5 million. Now you got General Electric and E.F. Hutton and all of them investing in the penitentiaries, and they invest their money for a profit line.
That's right.
And they're the same individuals that donate money to the legislative body to make laws to lock individuals up.
Very good point, Wiles. And any questions, Amy, from your end?
Yes, I do have a question. Let me ask you something, Gator. Danny Davis, the candidate, the most progressive candidate in the 7th District Congressional race in Chicago that you endorsed, how did he receive your endorsement?
Well, see, first of all, Amy, all the candidates that came to me for support, and that's what I really hate. I hate the hypocrisy. I even have Ed Smith on video coming to me for support.
Who's one of Davis's opponents?
Right, who's one of Davis's opponents. Okay, Bobby Steele is one of his opponents, and have a smear campaign going on like the man is supporting a drug cartel, and that is a lie. And she came to me for support. I campaigned for her across the whole city. That's how she became the Cook County Commissioner. And I'm like, if I was good enough to help you get elected, how could I be wrong to support the most progressive candidate in this city? Because he does not have the Irish mafias pulling his string.
But he received your report. He welcomed your support.
Yeah, he did, because he did not solicit my support. That was one of the reasons why I went to him. And see, by me, they got to understand, I worked with Jerry Butler for 6 years. So I've been in
Jerry Butler, the former singer who's become a Cook County Commissioner.
Right. I was administrative assistant for 6 years. Okay, in 1988, I worked on Jackson's campaign. At the convention in 88, I was on his staff. You find what I'm saying? So I know the intricacies of politics, and I know how to research a candidate instead of just going with him, okay? And when I realized that all the other candidates that was running against Danny, either Daley was pulling their strings, Alderman Burke, Thompson, or Gary LaPelle.
All of these are machine candidates.
All these are machine candidates. They what we call the Irish Mafia. They got control of everything. Mm-hmm. You find what I'm saying? They represent 4% of the electorate, but they got control of every office.
Well, we hope to continue this discussion at a future point, see how these politics play out in Chicago. Salim Wakil, I want to thank you for joining us from Chicago.
Thank you, Amy.
Salim Wakil, again, senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. And also thank you very much to Wallace Gator Bradley joining us from Chicago. And you've been listening to Democracy Now! It's produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason, and you can reach us via email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. You can also write to us here in Washington. We are Democracy Now! 702 H Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2001. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, a conversation with Ohio Representative Marcy Kaptur, one of NAFTA's leading opponents on Capitol Hill. And later this week and next, we'll be taking a look at the anti-toxics movement around this country. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining me on Pacifica Radio's daily election show, Democracy Now!